The first person he saw was Boyle, who had a big smile on his face. Andrew was not discouraged by the smile as he watched the little slips of paper pour out of the boxes. Boyle had yet to learn that the first boxes to be counted were always from the inner wards, where most of the committed socialists lived. As both men walked round the tables, the little piles began to be checked, first in tens, then hundreds, until they were finally placed in thousands and handed over to the sheriff. As the night drew on, Boyle's smile turned to a grin, from a grin to a poker face, and finally to a look of anxiety as the piles grew closer and closer in size. For over 3 hours, the process of emptying the boxes continued, and the scrutineers checked each little white slip before handing in their own records. At 1:22 in the morning, the sheriff added up the list of numbers in front of him and asked the three candidates to join him. He told them the result. Frank Boyle smiled once again. Andrew showed no emotion, but called for a recount. For over an hour, he paced nervously around the room as the scrutineers checked and double-checked each pile. A change here, a mistake there, a lost vote discovered, and on one occasion, the name on the top of the pile of 100 votes was not the same as the 99 beneath it. At last, the scrutineers handed back their figures. Once again, the sheriff added up the columns of numbers and asked the candidates to join him. This time, Andrew smiled, while Boyle looked surprised and demanded another recount. The sheriff acquiesced, but said it must be the last time. Both candidates agreed in the absence of their conservative rival, who was sleeping soundly in a corner, secure in the knowledge that no amount of recounting would alter his position in the contest. Once again, the piles were checked and double-checked, and five mistakes were discovered in the 42,588 votes cast. At 3:20 a.m., with counters and checkers falling asleep at their tables, the sheriff once more asked the two candidates to join him. They were both stunned when they heard the result, and the sheriff informed them that there would be a further recount in the morning after his staff had managed to get some sleep. All the voting papers were then placed carefully back in the black boxes, locked, and left in the safekeeping of the local constabulary while the candidates crept away to their beds. Andrew slept in fits and starts through the remainder of the night. Louise, pale with exhaustion but still grinning, brought him a cup of tea at 8 in the morning. He took a cold shower, shaved slowly, and was back at the City Hall a few minutes before the count was due to recommence. As he walked up the steps, he was greeted by a battery of television cameras and journalists who had heard rumours as to why the count had been held up overnight, and knew they couldn't afford to be absent as the final drama unfolded. The counters looked eager and ready when the sheriff checked his watch and nodded. The boxes were unlocked and placed in front of the staff for the fourth time. Once again, the little piles grew from tens into hundreds and then into thousands. Andrew paced around the tables, more to burn up his nervous energy than out of a desire to keep checking. He had 30 witnesses registered as his counting agents to make sure he didn't lose by sleight of hand or genuine mistake. Once the counters and scrutineers had finished, they sat in front of their piles and waited for the slips to be collected and taken to the sheriff. When the sheriff had added up his little columns of figures for the final time, he found that no votes had changed hands. He explained to Andrew and Frank Boyle the procedure he intended to adopt in view of the outcome. He told both candidates that he had spoken to Lord Wiley at 9 that morning, and the Lord Advocate had read out the relevant statute in the election law that was to be followed in such circumstances. Both candidates agreed on which of the two choices they preferred. The sheriff walked up onto the stage with Andrew Fraser and Frank Boyle in his wake, both looking anxious. Everyone in the room stood to be sure of a better view of the proceedings. When the pushing back of chairs, the coughing and the nervous chattering had stopped, the sheriff began. First, he tapped the microphone that stood in front of him to be sure it was working. The metallic scratch was audible throughout the silent room. Satisfied, he began to speak. I, the returning officer for the district of Edinburgh Carlton, hereby declare the total number of votes cast for each candidate to be as follows. Frank Boyle, 18,437. Jamie Lomax, 5,714. Andrew Fraser, 18,437. The supporters of both the leading candidates erupted into a noisy frenzy. It was several minutes before the sheriff's voice could be heard above the babble of Scottish burrs. In accordance with Section 16 of the Representation of the People Act, 1949, and Rule 50 of the Parliamentary Election Rules in the second schedule of that Act, I am obliged to decide between tied candidates by lot, he announced. I have spoken with the Lord Advocate of Scotland, and have confirmed that the drawing of straws or the toss of a coin may constitute decision by lot for this purpose. Both candidates have agreed to the latter course of action. Pandemonium broke out again as Andrew and Boyle stood motionless on each side of the sheriff, waiting for their fate to be determined. I have borrowed from the Royal Bank of Scotland, continued the sheriff, aware that 20 million people were watching him on television for the first, and probably the last time in his life, a golden sovereign. On one side is the head of King George III, on the other, Britannia. I shall invite the sitting member, Mr. Fraser, to call his preference. Boyle curtly nodded his agreement. Both men inspected the coin. The sheriff rested the golden sovereign on his thumb, Andrew and Boyle still standing on either side of him. He turned to Andrew and said, You will call, Mr. Fraser, while the coin is in the air. The silence was such that they might have been the only three people in the room. Andrew could feel his heart thumping in his chest as the sheriff spun the coin high above him. Tails, he said clearly when the coin was at its zenith. The sovereign hit the floor and bounced, turning over several times before settling at the feet of the sheriff. Andrew stared down at the lady and sighed audibly. The sheriff cleared his throat before declaring, Following the decision by lot, I declare the aforementioned Mr. Andrew Fraser to be the duly elected Member of Parliament for Edinburgh Carlton. Andrew's supporters charged forward and onto the stage and carried him on their shoulders out of the City Hall and through the streets of Edinburgh. Andrew searched for Louise and Clarissa, but they were lost in the crush. The Royal Bank of Scotland presented the golden sovereign to the member the next day, and the editor of the Scotsman rang to ask if there had been any particular reason why he had selected Tails. Naturally, Andrew replied. George III lost America for us. I wasn't going to let him lose Edinburgh for me. Chapter 29 Raymond read the Daily Mail caption again and smiled on the toss of a coin. It saddened Raymond that Andrew had felt it necessary to leave the Labour Party, although he was delighted that he had been returned to the Commons. Raymond was only thankful there had been no Frank Boyles in his constituency. He often wondered if it was because Joyce kept such a watchful eye on all the committees. Margaret Thatcher's second victory had come as a bitter blow to him, although he couldn't have pretended it was a surprise. Her overall majority of 144 was even larger than had been predicted, while the SDP managed only 6 seats, although the Alliance were only 2 percentage points behind Labour in actual votes cast. Raymond was enough of a realist to know that now nothing was going to stop the Tories from governing for another 5-year term. Once again, Raymond returned to his practice at the bar and a new round of time-consuming briefs. When the Lord Chancellor, Lord Hailsham, offered him the chance to become a High Court judge with a place in the House of Lords, Raymond gave the matter considerable thought before finally asking Joyce for her opinion.
"You'd be bored to tears in a week," she told him.
"No more bored than I am now.
Your turn will come."
"Joyce, I'm nearly 50, and all I have to show for it is the chairmanship of the Select Committee on Trade and Industry. If the party fails to win next time, I may never hold office again. Don't forget the last occasion we lost this badly, we were in opposition for 13 years. Once Michael Foote has been replaced, the party will take on a new look, and I'll bet you'll be offered one of the senior shadow jobs."
"That'll depend on who's our next leader," said Raymond. "And I can't see a great deal of difference between Neil Kinnock, who looks unbeatable, and Michael Foote, except that Kinnock's 10 years younger than I am."
"Then why not stand yourself?" asked Joyce.
"It's too early for me," said Raymond.
"Then why don't you at least wait until we know who's going to be the leader of the party?" said Joyce. "You can be a judge at any time. They die off just as quickly as cabinet ministers."
When Raymond returned to his chambers the following Monday, he followed Joyce's advice and let Lord Hailsham know that he was not interested in being a judge in the foreseeable future, and settled down to keep a watchful eye on Cecil Parkinson, the new Secretary of State for Trade and Industry. Only a few days later, Michael Foote announced that he would not be standing for leader when the party's annual conference took place. When he informed the Shadow Cabinet, several faces lit up at the thought of the forthcoming battle at Brighton in October. Neil Kinnock and Roy Hattersley became the front runners, while during the weeks leading up to the conference, several trade unionists and MPs approached Raymond and asked him to stand. But he told them all, "Next time." The vote for the new leader took place on the Sunday before the conference began. As Raymond predicted, Kinnock won easily, and Hattersley, his closest rival, was elected as his deputy. After the conference, Raymond returned to Leeds for the weekend, still confident that he would be offered a major post in the Shadow Cabinet, despite the fact that he hadn't supported the winner. Having completed his morning surgery, he hung around the house waiting for the new leader to call him, even missing the match against Chelsea. He didn't like being in the second division. When Neil Kinnock eventually phoned late that evening, Raymond was shocked by his offer and replied without hesitation that he was not interested. It was a short conversation. Joyce came into the drawing room as he sank back into his favourite armchair.
"Well, what did he offer you?"
she asked, facing him.
"Transport. Virtually a demotion."
"What did you say?"
"I turned him down, of course."
"Who is he giving the main jobs to?"
"I didn't ask, and he didn't volunteer. But I suspect we'll only have to wait for the morning papers to find out. Not that I'm that interested," he continued, staring at the floor, "as I intend to take the first place that comes free on the bench. I've wasted too many years already."
"So have I," said Joyce quietly.
"What do you mean?"
asked Raymond, looking up at his wife for the first time since she'd come into the room.
"If you're going to make a complete break, I think it's time for me to do so as well."
"I don't understand," said Raymond.
"We haven't been close for a long time, Ray," said Joyce, looking straight into her husband's eyes. "If you're thinking of giving up the constituency and spending even more time in London, I think we should part."
She turned away.
"Is there someone else?"
asked Raymond, his voice cracking.
"No one special."
"But someone?"
"There is a man who wants to marry me," said Joyce, "if that's what you mean. We were at school in Bradford together. He's an accountant now, and has never married."
"But do you love him?"
Joyce considered the question.
"No, I can't pretend I do. But we're good friends. He's very kind and understanding. And more important, he's there.
Raymond couldn't move.
And the break would at least give you the chance to ask Kate Garthwaite to give up her job in New York and return to London.
Raymond gasped.
Think about it and let me know what you decide.
She left the room quickly so that he could not see her tears. Raymond sat alone in the room and thought back over his years with Joyce and Kate and knew exactly what he wanted to do now that the whole affair was out in the open. He caught the last train to London the same evening because he had to be in court by 10 o'clock the next morning to attend the judge's summing up. In the flat that night, he slept intermittently as he thought about how he would spend the rest of his new life. Before he went into the court the next morning, he ordered a dozen red roses via Interflora. He phoned the Attorney General. If he was going to change his life, he must change it in every way. When the summing up was over and the judge had passed sentence, Raymond checked the plane schedules. Nowadays, you could be there in such a short time. He booked his flight and took a taxi to Heathrow. He sat on the plane praying it wasn't too late and that too much time hadn't passed. The flight seemed endless, and he took another taxi from the airport. When he arrived at her front door, she was astonished.
"What are you doing here on a Monday afternoon?"
"I've come to try and win you back," said Raymond.
"Christ, that sounds corny," he added. "It's the nicest thing you've said in years," she said,
as he held her in his arms. Over Joyce's shoulder, Raymond could see the roses brightening up the drawing room.
"Let's go and have a quiet dinner."
Over dinner, Raymond told Joyce of his plans to accept the Attorney General's offer to join the bench, but only if she would agree to live in London. After a second bottle of champagne, which Joyce had been reluctant to open, they finally returned home. When they arrived back a little after one, the phone was ringing. Raymond opened the door and stumbled towards it, while Joyce groped for the light switch.
"Ray, I've been trying to get you all night,"
a lilting Welsh voice said.
"Have you now?"
Raymond said thickly, trying to keep his eyes open.
"You sound as if you've been to a good party."
"I've been celebrating with my wife."
"Celebrating before you've heard the news?"
"What news?" said Raymond, collapsing into the armchair.
"I've been juggling the new team around all day, and I was hoping you would agree to join the Shadow Cabinet as..."
Raymond sobered up very quickly and listened carefully to the new leader.
"Can you hold the line?"
"Of course," said the surprised voice on the other end.
"Joyce,"
said Raymond as she came out of the kitchen, clutching two mugs of very black coffee,
"would you agree to live with me in London if I don't become a judge?"
A broad smile spread across Joyce's face with the realization that he was seeking her approval. She nodded several times.
"I'd be delighted to accept," he said. "Thank you, Raymond. Perhaps we could meet at my room in the Commons tomorrow and talk over policy in your new field."
"Yes, of course," said Raymond.
"See you tomorrow."
He dropped the phone on the floor and fell asleep in the chair. Joyce replaced the phone and didn't discover until the following morning that her husband was the new Shadow Secretary of State for Social Services. Raymond sold his flat in the Barbican, and he and Joyce moved into a small Georgian house in Cowley Street, only a few hundred yards from the House of Commons. Raymond watched Joyce decorate his study first, and then she set about the rest of the house with the energy and enthusiasm of a newlywed. Once she had completed the guest bedroom, Raymond's parents came down to spend the weekend. He burst out laughing when he greeted his father at the door, clutching onto a bag marked Gould, the family butcher.
"They do have meat in London, you know," said Raymond.
"Not like mine, son,"
his father replied. Over the finest beef Raymond could remember, he watched Joyce and his mother chatting away.
"Thank God I woke up in time," he said out loud.
"What did you say?" asked Joyce.
Nothing, my dear. Nothing.
This ends side one of cassette 9. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
Although Raymond spent most of his time on the overall strategy for a future Labour government, like all politicians, he had pet anomalies that particularly upset him. His had always been war widows' pensions, a preoccupation which dated back to his living with his grandmother in Leeds. He remembered the shock when he first realized, shortly after leaving university, that his grandmother had eked out an existence for 30 years on a weekly widow's pension that wouldn't have covered the cost of a decent meal in a London restaurant. From the back benches, he had always pressed for the redeeming of war bonds and higher pensions for war widows. His weekly mail showed unequivocally just how major a problem war widows' pensions had become. During his years in opposition, he had worked doggedly to achieve ever-increasing smaller rises, but he vowed that were he to become Secretary of State, he would enact something more radical. Joyce left a cutting from the Standard for him to read when he returned from the Commons that night. She had scribbled across it, "This could end up on the front page of every national paper." Raymond agreed with her. On the following day, he tried to press his view onto a reluctant shadow cabinet, who seemed more concerned with the planned series of picketing by the Yorkshire Miners' Union than the case of Mrs. Dora Benson. Raymond researched the story carefully and discovered that the case didn't differ greatly from the many others he had looked into over the years, except for the added ingredient of a Victoria Cross. By any standards, Mrs. Dora Benson highlighted Raymond's cause. She was one of the handful of surviving widows of the First World War, and her husband, Private Albert Benson, had been killed at the Somme, leading an attack on a German trench. 9 Germans had been killed before Albert Benson died, which was why he had been awarded the VC. His widow had continued working as a cleaner in the King's Head at Barking for over 50 years. Her only possessions of any value were her war bonds, but with no redemption date, they were still passing hands at £25 each. Mrs. Benson's case might have gone unnoticed if, in desperation, she had not asked Sotheby's to auction her husband's medal. Once Raymond had armed himself with all the facts, he put down a question to the minister concerned, asking if he would at last honour the government's long-promised pledges in such cases. A sleepy but packed House heard Simon Carslake, as Minister of State for Defence, reply that his department was once again considering the problem, and he would make known their findings in the near future. Simon settled back onto the green benches, satisfied that would pacify Gould. But Raymond's supplementary stunned him and woke up the House. "Does the Right Honourable Gentleman realise that this 84-year-old widow, whose husband was killed in action and won the Victoria Cross, has a lower income than a 16-year-old cadet on his first day in the armed forces?" Simon rose once more, determined to put a stop to the issue until he had had more time to study the details of this particular case.
"I was not aware of this fact, Mr. Speaker, and I can assure the Right Honourable Gentleman that I shall take into consideration all the points he has mentioned."
Simon felt confident the Speaker would now move on to the next question, but Raymond rose again, the opposition benches spurring him on.
"Is the Right Honourable Gentleman also aware that an admiral on an index-linked income can hope to end his career with a pension of over £500 a week, while Mrs. Dora Benson's weekly income
remains fixed at £47.32. There was a gasp even from the Conservative benches as Raymond sat down. Simon rose again, painfully aware that he was unprepared for Gould's attack and that he had to stifle it as quickly as he could. I was not aware of that particular comparison either, but once again I can assure the Right Honourable Gentleman I will give the case my immediate consideration. To Simon's horror, Raymond rose from the benches for yet a third time. He could see that Labour members opposite were enjoying the rare spectacle of watching him up against the ropes. Is the Right Honourable Gentleman also aware that the annuity for a Victoria Cross is £100 with no extra pension benefits? We pay our 4th Division footballers more while keeping Mrs. Benson in the bottom league of the national income bracket. Simon looked distinctly harassed when he in turn rose for a fourth time and made an uncharacteristic remark that he regretted the moment he said it. I take the Right Honourable Gentleman's point, he began, his words coming out a little too quickly, and I'm fascinated by his sudden interest in Mrs. Benson. Would it be cynical of me to suggest that it has been prompted by the wide publicity this case has enjoyed in the national press? Raymond made no attempt to answer, but sat motionless with his arms folded and his feet up on the table in front of him, while his own back benches screamed their abuse at Simon. The national papers the next day were covered with pictures of the arthritic Dora Benson with her bucket and mop, alongside photos of her handsome young husband in private's uniform. Many of the papers went on to describe how Albert Benson had won his VC, and some of the tabloids used considerable license. But all of them picked up Raymond's point that Mrs. Benson was in the bottom 1% of the income bracket, and that the annuity for a Victoria Cross was a pathetic £100. It was an enterprising and unusually thorough journalist from The Guardian who led her story on a different angle, which the rest of the national press had to turn to in their second edition. It transpired that Raymond Gould had put down 47 questions concerning war widows' pension rights during his time in the House, and had spoken on the subject in 3 budgets and 5 social service debates from the back benches. He had also made the subject the thrust of his maiden speech over 20 years before. But when the journalist revealed that Raymond gave £500 a year to the Erskine Hospital for Wounded Soldiers, every member knew that Simon Carslake would have to retract his attack and make an apology to the House. At 3:30, the Speaker rose from his chair and told a packed House that the Minister of State for Defence wished to make a personal statement. Simon Carslake rose warily from the front bench and stood nervously at the dispatch box. Mr. Speaker, he began, with your permission and that of the House, I would like to make a personal statement. During a question put to me yesterday, I impugned the integrity of the Right Honourable Gentleman, the member for Leeds North. It has since been brought to my attention that I did him a gross injustice, and I offer the House my sincere apologies and the Right Honourable Gentleman the assurances that I will not question his integrity a third time. While younger members were puzzled by the reference, Raymond smiled to himself. Aware of how rare personal statements were in anyone's parliamentary career, members looked on eagerly to see how he would respond. He moved slowly to the dispatch box. Mr. Speaker, I accept the gracious manner in which the Right Honourable Gentleman has apologised, and hope that he will not lose sight of the greater issue, namely that of war widows' benefits, and in particular, the plight of Mrs. Dora Benson. Simon looked relieved and nodded courteously. Many opposition members told Raymond that he should have gone for Simon when he had him on the run, while Tom Carson continued shouting at Simon long after the House had proceeded to the next business. The Times leader-writer proved them wrong when he wrote the next morning, In an age of militant demands from the left, Parliament and the Labour Party have found a new Clement Attlee on their front bench. Britain need have no fear for human dignity or the rights of man, should Raymond Gould ever accede to the high office which that gentleman held. When Raymond returned home from the Commons that night, he found Joyce had cut out all the press comments for him to study, and had also somehow managed to make inroads into his overflowing correspondence. Joyce turned out to have a better feel for gut politics than the entire shadow cabinet put together. Alec Pimkin threw a party for all his Tory colleagues who had entered the House in 1964 to celebrate the first 20 years in the Commons, as he described the occasion in an impromptu after-dinner speech. Over brandy and cigars, the corpulent, balding figure sat back and surveyed his fellow members. Many had fallen by the wayside over the years, but of those that were left, he believed only two men now dominated the intake. Pimkin's eyes first settled on his old friend, Charles Seymour. Despite studying him closely, he was still unable to spot a grey hair on the Treasury Minister's head. From time to time, Pimkin still saw Amanda, who had returned to being a full-time model and was rarely to be found in England nowadays. Charles, he suspected, saw more of her on covers of magazines than he ever did in his home at Eaton Square. Pimkin had been surprised by how much time Charles was willing to put aside for little Harry. Charles was the last man he would have suspected of ending up a doting father. Certainly there were no signs of his ambitions diminishing, and Pimkin suspected that only one man remained a worthy rival for the party leadership. His eyes moved on to someone for whom in 1984 Orwell's big brother seemed to hold no fears. Simon Carslake was deep in animated conversation about his work on the proposed disarmament talks between Thatcher, Gorbachev, and Reagan. Pimkin studied the defense minister intently. He considered that had he been graced with such looks, he would not have had to fear for his dwindling majority. Rumors of some financial crisis had long since died away, and Carslake now seemed well set for a formidable future. The party began to break up, as one by one his contemporaries came over to thank him for such a splendid, memorable, worthwhile evening. When the last one had departed, and Pimkin found himself alone, he drained the drop of brandy that remained in his balloon and stubbed out the dying cigar. He sighed as he speculated on the fact that he could now never hope to be made a minister. He therefore determined to become a kingmaker, for in another 20 years there would be nothing left on which to speculate. Raymond celebrated his 20 years in the House by taking Joyce to the Guinea restaurant off Berkeley Square for dinner. He admired the long burgundy dress his wife had chosen for the occasion, and even noticed that one or two women gave it more than a casual glance throughout their meal. He too reflected on his 20 years in the Commons, and he told Joyce, over brandy, that he hoped he would spend more of the next 20 years in government. 1984 had not turned out to be a good year for the Conservatives, and Raymond was already forming plans to make 1985 as uncomfortable for the government as possible. A few weeks later, Tony Benn, who had lost his seat at the general election, returned to the House of Commons as the member for Chesterfield. The Conservatives came a poor third and went on to lose two more by-elections early in 1985. Even the press began to acknowledge that the Labour Party was once again looking like a serious alternative government. The winter of 1985 brought a further rise in the unemployment figures, which only increased the Labour Party's lead in the polls. And then, after the resignation of two cabinet ministers over a small helicopter company in the West Country, and the loss of two further by-elections, the Conservatives fell into third place for the first time in 5 years. A drop in the price of oil from $22 to $10 a barrel in the space of 6 weeks did not help the Chancellor's budget judgment. After a long, hot summer, Mrs. Thatcher decided on a further cabinet reshuffle, bringing in those who would be formulating policy in the run-up to the general election. The average age of the cabinet fell by 7 years, and the press dubbed it Mrs. Thatcher's new lamps for old reshuffle. Chapter 30. Andrew was on his way to the House of Commons when he heard the first reports on his car radio. There had been no mention of the news in the morning papers, so it must have happened overnight. It began with a news flash, just the bare details. HMS Broadsword, one of the Navy's destroyers, had been passing through the Gulf of Sirte between Tunis and Benghazi when she was boarded by a group of mercenaries posing as Coast Guard officials, who took over the ship in the name of Colonel Gaddafi. The newscaster went on to say that there would be a more detailed report in their 10 o'clock bulletin. Andrew had reached his room in the House of Commons by 9:30, and he immediately phoned the SDP leader, David Owen, to discuss the political implications of the news. Once a course of action had been agreed on, Andrew took a handwritten letter round to the Speaker's office before the noon deadline, requesting an emergency debate following question time that afternoon. He also sent a copy of the letter by messenger to the Foreign Secretary and the Secretary of State for Defense. By staying near a radio most of the morning, Andrew was able to learn that HMS Broadsword was now in the hands of over 100 guerrillas. They were demanding the freedom of all Libyan prisoners in British jails in exchange for the 217-strong crew of the Broadsword who were being held hostage in the engine room. By 12 o'clock, the ticker tape machine in the members' corridor was hovered over by craning necks, and the dining rooms were so full that many members had to go without lunch. Question time that day had been allocated to Welsh affairs, so the chamber itself did not start filling up until nearly 3:15, although the Palace of Westminster was already packed and buzzing with each new snippet of information. Political correspondents waited hawk-like in the members' lobby, seeking opinions on the crisis from any senior politicians as they passed to and from the chamber. Few were rash enough to say anything that might be reinterpreted the next day. When Andrew came into the chamber, he took his seat next to David Owen on the opposition front bench below the gangway. Since Andrew had the overall responsibility for the Alliance defense portfolio, he was expected to represent the other 22 Alliance members. At 3:27, the Prime Minister, followed by the Foreign Secretary and the Secretary of State for Defense, filed into the House and took their places on the Treasury bench. All three looked suitably somber. The last two questions on Welsh affairs had the largest audience of members since the Aberfan disaster of 1966. At 3:30, Mr. Speaker Wetherill rose and called for order. "Statements to the House," he announced in his crisp military style. "There will be two statements on HMS Broadsword before the House debates Welsh affairs." The Speaker then called the Secretary of State for Defense. Simon Carslake rose from the front bench and placed a prepared statement on the dispatch box in front of him. "Mr. Speaker, with your permission and that of the House, I would like to make a statement concerning Her Majesty's frigate, Broadsword. At 7:40 GMT this morning, HMS Broadsword was passing through the Gulf of Sirte between Tunis and Benghazi when a group of guerrillas posing as official coast guards boarded the ship and seized the officer in command, Captain Lawrence Packard, and placed the crew under arrest. The captain and his company did everything possible to resist, but were outnumbered 3-1. The guerrillas, claiming to represent the People's Liberation Army, have since placed Captain Packard and the crew in the engine room of the ship. As far as it is possible to ascertain from our embassy in Tripoli, no lives have been lost, although Captain Packard sustained severe injuries during the battle, and we cannot be certain of his fate. There is no suggestion that Broadsword was doing anything other than going about her lawful business. This barbaric act must be looked upon as piracy under the 1958 Geneva Convention on the High Seas. The guerrillas are demanding the release of all Libyan prisoners in British prisons in exchange for the return of HMS Broadsword and her crew. My right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, informs me there are only 9 known Libyans in British jails at the present time, 2 of whom have been sentenced to 3 months for persistent shoplifting, 2 who were convicted on more serious drug charges, and the 5 who tried to hijack a British Airways 747 last year. Her Majesty's government cannot and will not interfere with the due process of law and has no intention of releasing any of these men. Loud hear-hears came from all sections of the House. My right honourable friend, the Foreign Secretary, has made Her Majesty's government's position clear to the Libyan ambassador, in particular that Her Majesty's government cannot be expected to tolerate this sort of treatment of British subjects or of British property. We have demanded and expect immediate action from the Libyan government. Simon sat down to loud and prolonged cheers before the leader of the opposition rose from his place to say that he would wish it to be known that the opposition gave the government their full backing. He asked if any plans had been formulated at this early stage for the recovery of Broadsword. Simon rose again. We are, Mr. Speaker, at present seeking a diplomatic solution, but I have already chaired a meeting of the Joint Chiefs, and I anticipate making a further statement to the House tomorrow. Mr. Andrew Fraser, said the Speaker. Andrew rose from his place. May I inform the Right Honourable Gentleman that we in the Alliance also concur with his views that this is an act of piracy. But can he tell the House how long he will allow negotiations to continue when it is well known throughout the diplomatic world that Gaddafi is a master of procrastination, especially if we were to rely on the United Nations to adjudicate on this issue? From the noise that greeted Andrew's question, it seemed that his views were shared by the majority of the House. Simon rose to answer the question. I accept the point the Honourable Gentleman is making, but he will know, having been a Minister of State for Defence himself, that I am not in a position to divulge any information which might imperil the safety of Broadsword. Question after question came at Simon. He handled them with such confidence that visitors to the Strangers' Gallery would have found it hard to believe that he had been invited to join the Cabinet only 5 weeks before. At 4:15, after Simon had answered the last question the Speaker was going to allow, he sank back on the front bench to listen to the statement from the Foreign Office. The House fell silent once again as the Foreign Secretary rose from his place and checked the large double-spaced sheets in front of him. All eyes were now on the tall, elegant man who was making his first official statement since his appointment. Mr. Speaker, with your permission and that of the House, I too would like to make a statement concerning HMS Broadsword. Once news had reached the Foreign Office this morning of the plight of Her Majesty's ship Broadsword, my office immediately issued a strongly worded statement to the government of Libya. The Libyan ambassador has been called to the Foreign Office, and I shall be seeing him again immediately. This statement and the questions arising from it has been completed. Raymond looked up at the Strangers' Gallery from his place on the opposition front bench. It was one of the ironies of modern diplomacy that the Libyan ambassador was sitting in the gallery making notes while the Foreign Secretary delivered his statement. He couldn't imagine Colonel Gaddafi inviting the British ambassador to take notes while he sat in his tent addressing his followers. Raymond was pleased to see an attendant ask the ambassador to stop writing. The prohibition dated from the time when the House had jealously guarded its privacy. Raymond's eyes dropped back to the front bench, and he continued to listen to Charles Seymour. Our ambassador to the United Nations has tabled a resolution to be debated by the General Assembly this afternoon, asking representatives to back Britain against this flagrant violation of the 1958 Geneva Convention on the High Seas. I confidently expect the support of the free world over this act of piracy against Her Majesty's ship Broadsword. Her Majesty's government will do everything in its power to ensure a diplomatic solution, bearing in mind that the lives of 217 British servicemen are still at risk. The leader of the opposition rose for a second time and asked at what point the Foreign Secretary would consider once again breaking off diplomatic relations with Libya. I naturally hope it will not come to that, Mr. Speaker, and I expect the Libyan government to deal quickly with their own mercenaries. Charles continued to answer questions from all sections of the House, but could only repeat that there was little new intelligence to offer the House at the present time. Raymond watched his two contemporaries as they displayed over 20 years of parliamentary skill in presenting their case. He wondered if this episode would make one of them Mrs. Thatcher's obvious successor. At 4:30, the Speaker, realizing nothing original had been said for some time, announced that he would allow one further question from each side before returning to the business of the day. He shrewdly called Alec Pimpkin, who sounded to Raymond like the very model of a modern Major General, and then Tom Carson, who suggested that Colonel Gaddafi was often grossly misrepresented by the British press. Once Carson had sat down, Mr. Speaker found it easy to move on to other business. The Speaker rose again and thanked the Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Edinburgh Carlton, for his courtesy in informing him that he would be making an application under Standing Order No. 10 for an emergency debate. The Speaker said that he had given the matter careful thought, but he reminded the House that under the terms of the Standing Order, he did not need to divulge the reasons for his decision, merely decide whether the matter should have precedence over the orders of the day. He ruled that the matter was not proper for discussion within the terms of Standing Order No. 10. Andrew rose to protest, but as the Speaker remained standing, he had to resume his seat. "This does not mean, however," continued Mr. Speaker, "that I would not reconsider such a request at a later date." Andrew realized that Charles Seymour and Simon Karslake must have pleaded for more time, but he was only going to allow them 24 hours. The clerk at the table rose and bellowed above the noise of members leaving the chamber, "Adjournment!" The Speaker called the Secretary of State for Wales to move the adjournment motion on the problems facing the Welsh mining industry. The chamber emptied of all but the 38 Welsh MPs who had been waiting weeks for a full debate on the principality's affairs. Andrew went straight to his office and tried to piece together the latest information from news bulletins before preparing himself for a full debate the following day. Simon made his way back to the Ministry of Defence to continue discussions with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, while Charles was driven quickly to the Foreign Office. When Charles reached his room, he was told by the permanent Under-Secretary that the Libyan ambassador awaited him. "Does he have anything new to tell us?" asked Charles.
"Frankly, nothing. It seems that we're not the only people who are unable to make any contact with Colonel Gaddafi."
"Send him in, then." Charles stubbed out his cigarette and stood by the mantelpiece below a portrait of Palmerston. Charles had never met the ambassador before, largely because he had taken over at the Foreign Office only 5 weeks previously. When Mr. Cardier, the 5-foot-1, dark-haired, immaculately dressed ambassador for Libya, entered the room, the office resembled nothing so much as a study in which a headmaster was about to tick off an unruly boy from the lower fifth. Charles was momentarily taken aback when he noticed the ambassador's old Etonian tie. He recovered quickly.
"Foreign Secretary," began Mr. Cardier.
"Her Majesty's government wishes to make it abundantly clear to your government," began Charles, not allowing the ambassador to complete his sentiments, "that we consider the act of boarding and holding Her Majesty's ship broadsword against her will as one of piracy on the high seas."
"May I say," began Mr. Cardier.
"No, you may not," said Charles, "and until our ship has been released, we shall do everything in our power to bring pressure, both diplomatic and economic, on your government."
"But may I just say," Mr. Cardier tried again.
"My Prime Minister also wants you to know that she wishes to speak to your head of state at the soonest possible opportunity. So I shall expect to hear back from you within the hour.
Yes, Foreign Secretary. But may I...
And you may further report that we will reserve our right to take any action we deem appropriate if you fail to secure the release into safe custody of HMS Broadsword and her crew by 12 noon tomorrow GMT. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, Foreign Secretary.
But I would like to ask...
Good day, Mr. Kerdier.
After the Libyan ambassador was shown out, Charles couldn't help wondering what it was he had wanted to know.
What do we do now? He asked when the permanent undersecretary returned, having deposited Mr. Kerdier in the lift.
We act out the oldest diplomatic game in the world.
What do you mean? Said Charles.
Our sit-and-wait policy.
We're awfully good at it, said the permanent undersecretary.
But then we've been at it for nearly 1,000 years.
Well, while we sit, let's at least make some phone calls. I'll start with Secretary of State Kirkpatrick in Washington, and then I'd like to speak to Gromyko in Moscow.
When Simon arrived back at the Ministry of Defense from the Commons, he was told that the Joint Chiefs were assembled in his office, waiting for him to chair the next strategy meeting. As he entered the room to take his place at the head of the table, the Joint Chiefs rose.
Good afternoon, gentlemen, Simon said. Please be seated. Can you bring me up to date on the latest situation, Sir John?
Admiral Sir John Fieldhouse, Chief of the Defense Staff, pushed up the half-moon glasses from the end of his nose and checked the notes in front of him.
Very little has changed in the last hour, sir, he began. The Prime Minister's office has still had no success in contacting Colonel Gaddafi. I fear we must now treat the capture of Broadsword as a blatant act of terrorism, rather similar to the occupation 7 years ago of the American embassy in Iran by students who backed the late Ayatollah Khomeini. In such circumstances, we can either jaw-jaw or war-war, to quote Churchill. With that in mind, this committee will have formed a detailed plan by the early evening for the recapture of HMS Broadsword, as we assume the Foreign Office are better qualified to prepare for jaw-jaw.
Sir John replaced his glasses and looked towards his minister.
Are you in a position to give me a provisional plan which I could place in front of the Cabinet for their consideration?
Certainly, Minister, said Sir John, removing his glasses again before opening a large blue file in front of him.
Simon listened intently as Sir John went over his provisional strategy. Around the table sat 8 of the senior-ranking staff officers of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and even the first draft plan bore the stamp of their 300 years of military experience. He couldn't help remembering that his call-up status was still that of a second lieutenant. For an hour, he asked the Joint Chiefs questions that ranged from the elementary to ones that demonstrated a clear insight into their problems. By the time Simon left the room to attend the cabinet meeting at number 10, the Joint Chiefs were already updating their plan. Simon walked slowly across Whitehall from the Department of Defense to Downing Street, his private detective by his side. Downing Street was thronged with people curious to see the comings and goings of ministers involved in the crisis. Simon was touched that the crowd applauded him all the way to the front door of number 10, where the journalists and TV crews awaited each arrival. The great television arc lights were switched on as he reached the door, and a microphone was thrust in front of him. But he made no comment. Simon was surprised by how many of the normally cynical journalists called out, "Good luck," and "Bring our boys home." The front door opened, and he went straight through to the corridor outside the cabinet room, where 22 of his colleagues were already waiting. A moment later, the Prime Minister walked into the cabinet room and took her seat in the centre of the table, with Charles and Simon opposite her. Mrs. Thatcher began by telling her colleagues that she had been unable to make any contact with Colonel Gaddafi and that they must therefore decide on a course of action that did not involve his acquiescence. She invited the Foreign Secretary to brief the cabinet first. Charles went over the actions in which the Foreign Office was involved at the diplomatic level. He reported his meeting with Ambassador Kadir and the resolution which had been tabled at the UN and was already being debated in an emergency session of the General Assembly. The purpose of asking the United Nations to back Britain on Resolution 1240, he said, was to gain the diplomatic initiative and virtually guarantee international sympathy. Charles went on to tell the Cabinet that he expected a vote to take place in the General Assembly in New York that evening, which would demonstrate overwhelming support for the United Kingdom's resolution, and which would be regarded as a moral victory by the whole world. He was delighted to be able to report to the Cabinet that the foreign ministers of both the United States and Russia had agreed to back the UK in her diplomatic endeavours as long as she launched no retaliatory action. Charles ended by reminding his colleagues of the importance of treating the whole affair as an act of piracy rather than an injury at the hands of the Libyan government itself. A legal nicety, thought Simon, as he watched the faces of his colleagues round the table. They were obviously impressed that Charles had brought the two superpowers together in support of Britain. The Prime Minister's face remained inscrutable. She called upon Simon to air his views. He was able to report that Broadsword had, since the last meeting of the Cabinet, been towed into the Bay of Surte and moored. There was no hope of boarding her except by sea. Captain Packard and his crew of 216 remained under close arrest in the engine room on the lower deck of the ship. From confirmed reports Simon had received in the last hour, it appeared that the ship's company were bound, gagged, and that the ventilation systems had been turned off. Captain Packard, he informed the Cabinet, had refused to cooperate with the guerrillas in any way, and we remain unsure of his fate. He paused. I therefore suggest, Simon continued, that we have no choice but to mount a rescue operation in order to avoid a protracted negotiation that can only end in grave loss of morale for the entire armed forces. The longer we put off such a decision, the harder our task will become. The Joint Chiefs are putting the final touches to a plan codenamed Shoplifter, which they feel must be carried out in the next 48 hours if the men and the ship are to be saved. Simon added that he hoped diplomatic channels would be kept open while the operation was being worked out, in order that the rescue team could be assured of the greatest element of surprise. "What if your plan fails?" interrupted Charles. "We would risk losing not only Broadsword and her crew, but also the goodwill of the free world." "There is no serving officer in the British Navy who will thank us for leaving Broadsword in Libyan waters while we negotiate a settlement in which, at best, our ship will be returned when it suits the guerrillas, to say nothing of the humiliation of our navy. Gaddafi can laugh at the United Nations while he's captured not only one of our most modern frigates, but also the headlines of the world's press. As Ayatollah Khomeini did, he'll want to keep them both for as long as he can. These headlines can only demoralize our countrymen and invite the sort of election defeat Carter suffered at the hands of the American people after the Iranian embassy debacle. We would be foolish to take such an unnecessary risk while we have world opinion on our side," protested Charles. "Let us at least wait a few more days." "I fear that if we wait," said Simon, "the crew will be transferred from the ship to a military prison, which would only result in our having two targets to concentrate on, and then Gaddafi can sit around in the desert taking whatever amount of time suits him." Simon and Charles weighed argument against counter-argument, while the Prime Minister listened, taking note of the views of her other colleagues round the table to see if she had a majority for one course or the other. 3 hours later, when everyone had given his opinion, she had 14-9 written on the pad in front of her.